Welcome to Behavior Analysis in Practice, the podcast. Behavior Analysis in Practice is a podcast committed to narrowing the research practice gap and demystifying the research process. Each episode will take a deep dive into the latest work published in Behavior Analysis in Practice, the journal, by interviewing the paper's author about the topic. We'll explore the nuances of each paper and ask the questions you wish you could ask the authors after reading the paper. Hello and welcome back to Behavior Analysis in Practice, the podcast. I'm the host, Cody Morris, Assistant Professor of Behavior Analysis at Salve Regina University. And today I'm going to be speaking with Denisha Jingles about two of her papers, one titled Leading the Charge, A Look Inside the Behavior Analysis in Practice, Emergency Series of Publications on Systemic Racism and Police Brutality, and the second paper, Igniting Collective Freedom, An Integrative Behavioral Model of Acceptance and Commitment Toward Black Liberation. Denisha is the clinical director and CEO of a full-service agency in Baltimore that provides behavioral services to children, teens, and young adults. She graduated from the University of Baltimore with a master's degree in counseling psychology and received her BCBA certificate through Endicott College in Beverly, Mass. Her interests include equitable practice, acceptance and commitment therapy, social justice, supervision, staff, parent training, and behavior assessment and intervention. My conversation with Denisha was really interesting. I learned a lot, and I'm really excited to share it all with you. So without further ado, here is my interview with Denisha Jingles. Hello, Denisha. Welcome to Behavior Analysis in Practice, the podcast.
Hello.
We're excited to have you here today and to talk about not just one paper, but two papers. And so this is going to be sort of a unique interview for the listeners who may not be used to this exact sort of layout of an interview. But Denisha was part of both an introduction to a special issue and then a paper within that that special issue that we'll be talking about. But before we get into those papers, we always like to hear a little bit about our guest. So Denisha, would you mind telling us a little bit about your background? What sort of led you to being interested in behavior analysis, what your role is, and why this research that these two papers focus on is important to you?
Yeah, of course. So I initially got started within the field of ABA in 2007. I, like many people that I've met, was a college student and stumbled upon the field. I went home for the summer. I went to undergraduate at Missouri State University, and I went home to St. Louis for the summer, and I wanted a job. And I figured if I was going to have a job, it needed to be within the field of psychology. So I started my search and I saw this job posting for an applied behavior analyst. That's what it was called at the time. So all I remember from this year is that something happened where ABA was emerging in that area, and they were hiring people to do this role within the school system. And so I went in and I didn't have an inkling of experience, but they hired me and I did my 40 hours. I remember it might have been more than that, honestly, at that time. I think I was in training for about 2 weeks and then went inside of the school that I would be working at for the summer. And I remember my supervisor just being like, oh, you're such a natural. This is great. And I'm like, okay, cool. You know, like it was a fun summer. And that was it. I didn't think too much of it. I went back to school that year, and I always went to school with the notion of becoming a counselor. So it was a little bit off from what I thought that I was going to do. But I like the job. There were some tough parts to it, and I always talk to people about when I came into the role of ABA, and a lot of my reflection lately has been, not lately, but a lot of my reflection over the years has been the ableism that I did not know how to navigate or didn't even have any terminology for really at that time. So it was difficult, but it was beautiful at the same time. I went back to school, continued on to, finalize my journey to become a counselor, went to graduate school. And so now it's a few years later, and I'm in grad school in Baltimore, Maryland, and I need a job again. And so I saw some job postings and saw another ABA position available. And so I remember brushing up on the terminology really quickly, brushing up on what I did in those sessions so that I could pass this interview with flying colors. And I did. And I got that job. And I worked as an ABA therapist throughout grad school. And I remember being in this job, and people were talking about the RBT was just now becoming a thing. And so they were talking about gearing up for it. And I was like, I don't need to do any of that. I am going to be out of here. And I'll be on my way to be a counselor again. And so I graduate and I go on. I graduate with my degree in counseling psychology. I moved to New York and I'm doing stuff within that field. And it was really hard. I was working within a safe haven system. And so that's with chronically homeless individuals or unhoused individuals. And it started to have me think that it was time to go somewhere else after a little bit over a year. And so I saw this behavior specialist posting. And again, I was like, well, let's see what's going on here. And I brushed up again on my terminology. This time I knew I would have to go. It would be a different brushing up that would need to occur because it's different being an ABA therapist to now you're trying to interview for a job that's a behavior specialist where you're really the one that's going to be running the programming. And so I brushed up on it in a very, different way, but intentional so that I could potentially get this role. And I did get the role. And oddly enough, I remember the psychologist who leads the program. He was like, Denisha, you were the best interview we ever had. And I was like, that's interesting. Because I did not know really what I was doing. And so I got that job. And this was around, so what year was this? I think it was 2014. 2014 was the year that I received this job. And this was also the year that we were in an uprising. So after the murders of Michael Brown in St. Louis, also after Eric Garner in New York City, we were on the streets. And so I've always been a social justice activist. I've always been someone that's, I should say, not always, right? But as a undergraduate student, I was studying systems, recognizing systems, and then trying to put some terminology to my experiences. And so in New York, I was hitting the streets and I was protesting. I was finding my justice family at the time that I was like now in this role within behavior analysis. And I just believe that it was a beautiful emergence or convergence that was happening at the same time because it really started to shift the way that I was thinking. Because here I was fighting for the rights of Black folks to be able to live and breathe and exist. And then here I had this science that I was like learning about, and it was telling me about the ways in which that we can address problems of human nature, essentially. And so I decided I wanted to go back to school. I know I wanted to be a BCBA. And my goal was so that I could understand how, again, to converge my worlds, the worlds that I was experiencing. Because when I went into the social justice space, there's no one else speaking like I am speaking in the behavior analytic space. And when I go into the behavior analytic space, there's no one speaking how I'm speaking in the social justice space. So I went to school and I studied, and I was like, this is it. I remember specifically thinking about my experience as a child in schools and saying, like, wow, positive reinforcement, it's like simple as we learn it, right? But imagine if I went to schools that also prioritized positive reinforcement, just that alone, right? And I really felt like this was my calling. Like, this was the thing. And I, like, if my friends could tell you about that time when they would hear me speak, I was just like, this is it. Like, I was so excited about the science of behavior analysis. And I keep that within me throughout all the things that go on within our field, despite all the changes that need to be made. I remember being so invigorated by this science and truly believing that it could be something that the world could benefit from, in such a way that I hadn't experienced with anything else. So I am a counselor. I said I went to school to become a counselor. I am a counselor, but I am also a board certified behavior analyst and a licensed behavior analyst. And I, cross those two and three worlds, every day of my practice. I own a practice in Baltimore, Maryland, Signature Behavioral Health. That is my Shirley Chisholm used to say, like, the service that we do is our rent to the world, essentially. And so I believe that Signature is the rent that I'm paying to the world. When I created it, it was based on a need, seeing the things that I felt needed changing in some of the environments that I worked in. And so I wanted to be the change that I sought. And that's where Signature was birthed. That's when it was birthed, I should say. And yeah, we provide behavior analytic services, but also counseling services, trauma, depression, anxiety. I work with adults and also children within that realm. And yeah, the last thing I guess I'll say, and then let me know if I answered all of your questions or not. I don't know. But I did serve as the editor in chief, the guest editor in chief of the special edition for the papers that we'll be discussing today. And I did that alongside a few people, and I'm sure we'll talk about them momentarily. But yeah, that was such a different experience for me. And I think at some point we'll probably talk about how that process became to be.
Yeah, and I think that's a perfect sort of segue into that. But before we head into that special issue, out of curiosity, your organization Signature, is that based mostly out of Baltimore, or do you provide services telehealth, or like is that what's the range on that for people who might be interested?
Yeah, so we provide ABA services locally. So that is the Baltimore community. But when it comes to counseling, that is telehealth. So that is to the Maryland community.
Awesome. Thank you. So, looking at the special issue and your involvement with it and sort of the need for it, for context for those listening, the title of the introduction to this special issue is Leading the Charge: A Look Inside the Behavior Analysis and Practice Emergency Series of Publications on Systemic Racism and Police Brutality. It was yourself, Jamila Watson-Thompson, Kasten Anderson-Carpenter, Jonathan Tarbox, and Stephanie Peterson. Is that right?
Yes, that is correct.
So can you tell us a little bit about the purpose of this special issue? What was it focusing on, and why is it important?
Yeah, so I'm going to flash you back to 2020, June of 2020 to be exact. We were now in another resurgence for another uprising for social justice. And this time it was for the murder of George Floyd. Breonna Taylor had occurred around the same time. And so Elijah McClain was around the same time. And it was radio silence from our field. And I remember when COVID struck, people were scrambling in our field. And I remember specifically Dr. Tarbox, Jonathan, and Jonathan and I, we have a good relationship. So he reached out, and he was reaching out to people and saying, I need you all to, like, please, like, submit on this, like, emergency series for COVID. And rightfully so, COVID still wrecks us. It really wrecked us in 2020, but it is still wreaking havoc on all of us. And so rightfully so, he moved into action, and behavior analysis as a field moved into action. And it was commendable. But here we were in June and everyone was silent. And so I cannot be silent. And I called them out for it. And I said, you all moved really swiftly for COVID. Where are you now? What will you do in this time? How will you act? And Jonathan, just kind of being who he is, he was like, well, I do want to act. And how can we do this? And he wrote me with this potential to be the editor of this special edition. And his rationale behind it was because I'm not only someone who has grown to understand systemic issues from a behavior analytic side, but I'm someone who actually is boots on the ground. I'm someone who actually, lives those values out loud within a social justice space. And to me, that was critical. As I reviewed papers, that also was critical as well, because I knew at the end of the series, if I could not take these papers to or show these papers to people within the social justice space and they understood it or they said, okay, I failed. It was never about behavior analysts. I mean, yes, our field needed to have this information put in, but also it's about the people that it's impacting directly, our community, and also social justice activists who know about this work. And so, immediately I thought on it and I said yes eventually. And if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it with my values in mind. And so the first thing that needed to happen was that I needed to choose associate editors. I knew that they were going to be Black. They were going to be people that were impacted by the topic at hand. And so Jamela Watson, Dr. Jamela Watson Thompson, and Dr. Kasten Anderson Carpenter were the people that I sought out to be part of this special edition as associate editors. Once that was done, we needed a reviewer team. Again, it was going to be necessary that our reviewer team also was representative of the community, but also was diverse as well. So most of all of our reviewers represented at least one marginalized community. That was important, but most of them were Black and Brown reviewers. And so, yeah, it came to be because it was a call out, a call in, whichever one you might call it. And then Jonathan said, let's move into action. Let's go ahead and make this a reality. And we went from there.
I always find really any time that behavior analysts bring in other worlds, other worldviews, other disciplines, other approaches, and then find that commonality, find those behavior analytic conceptualizations or maybe adaptations in some cases to some of the existing ideas, is when we can really sort of push the field forward in an exciting new way, right? Because, behavior analysts aren't the only ones that are doing amazing work out there and working extremely hard and coming up with ways to help impact the world. And so when we sort of look broadly and go, oh, these people are doing stuff that like aligns with the values of behavior analysis and would inform, behavior analysis bringing that in. And this, I think, is a perfect example of that, of we have this societal crisis or this time where as a society we need to reflect on ourselves and figure out how can we change this moving forward. And as you said, folks like yourself taking the initiative to take that leadership charge and go, hey, let's create an outlet for this and to start hopefully chipping away in a meaningful way at this issue in society. So this is an exciting special issue and opportunity for behavior analysis and practice and in the field at large. And there are several exciting, interesting papers within this special issue. Could we talk about some of the themes that emerged within the special issue of different papers that were being published within it?
Yeah, so there were a lot of themes that came up within the edition, the special edition. And so some of the themes, people were really They really wanted to focus on the work of us as professionals. And so inside of the special edition, you'll see some people that covered that. So an example was one of the papers talked about what we can do in terms of leading special education programs or higher education programs, making sure that we are looking at power differentials within our programs. And so that was useful. People really wanted to provide like practical tools inside of this special edition. So you had people that developed a tool for talking to autistic kids about racism, for example. You had Dr. Anita Lee, who wanted to discuss how to have solidarity between their community and the Black community, but utilizing those like practical steps on how to actually accomplish it. We also got to hear from the perspective of Black autistic women in the special edition as well, which honestly, when I was in school, I can't remember ever reading about that. And so that was, even though that wasn't a theme, but that's something that we were able to pull out of it. And then just in general, I think like our research practices was another theme that was inside of the special edition. Dr. Malaika Pritchard, for example, talked about participatory research. Yeah, so those were quite a few themes that were in the special edition.
What really impressed me about this special issue, having read it myself, is sort of the span of topics, right? I mean, as you said, this is a, in some ways, a newer foray into some of these concepts and ideas for behavior analysts, at least in publication. But to see the range of topics and the breadth that the special issue was able to bring in, I thought was really interesting and exciting to be able to explore some of these complex, again, somewhat outside of the traditional purview, or at least the purview to that point within behavior analysis. And so I found that to be really, really interesting. Now we're going to dive sort of more deeply into your paper that was within this special issue. And so this question may in some ways be answered within the conversation within your specific paper. But I think that one of the goals of any special issue is to inspire future action in that area, on that topic. For looking at this special issue, looking at the work that was done for it, thinking about the work that's been done after it, what do you think or sort of hope comes next for this topic, for this work?
When I went into the special edition, I had the future in mind. So it was not something that I haphazardly jumped into. Before Jonathan and I got started, we had a strategy meeting, and I told him, if I'm going to put my labor into this, this is what I'm expecting, like moving forward. And this is what I would hope to be the next steps moving forward. The first thing was that you needed to call upon someone who had social justice experience. And I was not your like he I wasn't the person that people would assume would do this special edition. I'll say that I'm not in academia. I'm not a doctor, not Dr. Jingles. And so you have this master's level person that you need to call in because she has an expertise that, and I'm quite frankly, that other people in the field don't have. And that was telling in itself. So what is going to be the pipeline to instill? And actually, let me say this. I'll go back. There are other people who have the expertise. I do want to say that I'm not the only one who has an expertise, but there is a reason why I had to be chosen. And so with that said, there needs to be a pipeline for more people who are not only well-versed in behavior analysis as a science, but really like well-versed in social justice pedagogy, so much so that again, it's aligned with like their actions and they do it locally, And so we talked about a potential social justice editor, right? Someone else that would come along that it's not just going to be, a one-off person, and that hasn't happened yet. I don't believe so, but that's one of the things that we talked about, and I would anticipate for the future. I would hope for the future. We also talked about more Black and Brown folks being in these positions, right? At the point of time, no one could name a past Black editor. So as far as we're concerned, I was the first Black editor, guest or full editor. There had never been another person to exist that looks like me, whether woman, man, or person, non-binary person. There had never been another Black person. So that also was something that was very telling within the field. And so, as well as reviewers, opening up that pipeline, there were Black reviewers, but opening up the pipeline for more Black reviewers, opening up the pipeline for more Black editors, I mean authors as well, was were critical things for me when I was starting this project. And so it was very much important to me, so much so that I that was a tongue twister, but it was important to me so much so that I went out and I spoke to people from other fields, asked people if they would be mentors to people who were thinking about writing for this special edition. I spoke to people within our field as well. I went to Black folks directly that I knew were doing this work on the floor, on the ground, and said, "Hey, please write. Please be part of this. Your voice needs to be heard inside of our literature." And so that was important for me to like create that pipeline. And I'm really happy that I've seen this pipeline continue after my special edition. I've seen Black editors for other special editions and other journals occur after my time. And I've seen a lot of Black reviewers come forward. And so those are the things that were really important to me. And as we continue to look at the positive impact of the special edition, that matters, as well as the topics at hand matter for me as well. We've seen more people writing about these topics. If you go back into the literature in general, you see that, there was like this baseline that was like somewhere near zero, and then there was like a spike around the 70s around social justice topics, and then it just flatlined again. And so then we have this 2020 resurgence. And what I would hope to see is a stable trend, right? A stable trend of people talking about these topics, researching these topics, and literally having them in our literature, not as just one specific sprinkle of time, but I want it to be so embedded into the fabric of our science, just like verbal behavior is. Like people, we can always go look and find a quick study of something around verbal behavior, social justice. I would like to be one of them as well.
That makes sense, and I think I'm sure from your perspective, it sounds like the end goal is sustained, meaningful involvement in behavior analysis, to have this not be some one-off, that it was it's extremely helpful and important in the moment, but that it didn't just sort of flare up and dissipate, that ultimately it sort of arose and then sustained, and that more and more people are contributing to these areas. And from my limited experience as a reviewer on behavior analysis and practice in some other journals, could be selection bias, but it certainly seems like there is more and more research coming out on this topic. It seems like people are interested in contributing on this topic and to trying to help continue this push. Does that seem, from your perspective, does that seem to align with what you're seeing as well?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think that there's been lots more literature over the past couple of years. I would like to add, what I would like to also see is real action on a systemic level inside of our field. That is what is the slow moving needle, it seems like. And so some of the larger institutions who are slower to change, slower to adopt new ways of being, I would like to see them moving towards that direction. But in general, there has been more literature, and that is a direct reflection of a lot of the practitioners and the scientist practitioners in our field and the researchers in our field that are wanting to put that in. But I do think it's going to be necessary that our institutions also adapt and adopt to some of the things that are being put in our literature.
That makes a lot of sense, and I think to an extent your individual paper that we're gonna talk about in just a moment, I think might be related to this topic in many ways. And so if we segue over to that, your paper is titled Igniting Collective Freedom, an Integrative Behavioral Model of Acceptance and Commitment Toward Black Liberation, that you published within this special issue. You describe the aim of the paper as offering a framework and suggestions for quantifying and targeting behaviors to encourage Black psychological liberation in the service of actualizing freedom. Can you unpack that? Can you tell us like what that means and why that's important?
Yeah. So the first thing I'll say is when you think of the world, it's so important, especially as a behavior analyst, to not only be able to identify the specific behaviors that you want to reduce, but you need to be able to identify the behaviors that you want to increase. And I got to this point where it was time for me to start writing. And I knew that a lot of my work was built upon liberatory practices. And so that's really radical imagination, right? That's talking about the future. What do you want to put in its place? And I believe that we need to be able to do that. I believe that it offers us a point of hope as well. When I wrote this in particular, this was for Black folks. Yes, I believe that everyone else could benefit for this, benefit from this, but I wanted to create something that specifically talked about instilling and igniting Black liberatory practices within us. And so it was from a place of radical imagination, but also obviously behavior analytic framework. And I wanted us to really start to think about the impact that racism has had on Black people and the internalization of racism, that has occurred with Black people and how we can expand our experiences beyond that. So that really is what went into the paper.
Thank you for explaining that. The paper starts off, or sort of early on, begins by defining the problem and talking about some of these systemic issues, amongst other things. Can you talk about the issue toward that is sort of interfering with Black liberation, as you described in the paper?
Yeah, so in order for us, again, we need to be able to describe the problem. We need to be able to define the problem. And so white supremacy is a problem for Black liberation. Racism is a problem for Black liberation. And so it needed to, I had to note that white supremacy, racism, oppression in general serve as immediate threats to Black liberation.
Thank you. And on that topic of like sort of taking that behavior analytic approach and defining things, you define Black liberation, which you've already sort of explained a little bit of. But what I found very interesting about your sort of exploration of the idea of Black liberation is you provide a sort of a traditional definition within the paper, but then you dive into the details of it from like a looking at it as a concept of value and outcome, which I found fascinating. So could you kind of walk us through that and sort of talk about why it's important to look at Black liberation from those different lenses and sort of describe it accordingly?
Yeah. So I split those up. The first one was the concept, and this is going to be just in general. When we start talking about things, we say, like, what does it mean, right? So, a concept of Black liberation is going to have meaning for individuals. And so, people are going to, one of the parts that I put in there was people can either conceptualize it as attacked, so what it is. And they could do that by tacting like actual behavior to describe Black liberation. Or it could be a man. And so we hear that a lot, especially in social justice spaces, that people are demanding their freedom. I start the paper out with Mans for Liberation. And it's by a poet, Jessica Kaer-Morton. And she's like, we want our bodies back, right? And so people can tact it, they can man what Black liberation is to them. And then the value is that I care about this thing deeply. I want to see this actualized, right? And so, what we know about values are that they're rules that function as verbal motivating operations, right? And so, I deeply, inherently want to actualize Black liberation and then an outcome. So, there can be no dreaming without us actually seeing the tangible fruit of Black liberation. And so that's going to be either the decrease of certain things and the increase of certain things. And the reason why that's important is, especially within certain spaces that people have privilege, they might spend a lot of time in that concept and value part and forget all about the outcome part that needs to be also apparent. And so it was necessary for me to break down those three within this paper so that people, one, recognize that we can talk about this in different ways, but we can also get very clear about it. And also we need to have some specific outcomes as a result of this dreaming and this valuing.
Related to spending a lot of time in this sort of conceptualization phase, do you find through your work that some of the reason that people get stuck in that rather than moving on to like actual outcomes and actual actions is like a perfectionism where it's like, look, if we don't have the perfect idea to move forward with sort of whatever specific topic within this area, we can't move forward at all. And you get stuck in this like analysis paralysis where it's like, no, we got to keep thinking and we've got to find a thing that fits and does everything perfectly. Is that something you see?
Yeah. So for people who've ever been inside any of my talks, and it's actually inside of this paper too, where I say, like, we're not going to unlearn this stuff. And the reason why I feel like talking about it in a way that's behavior analytic versus just taking that framework of unlearning is important is because there's a lot of pressure that comes with just even thinking about unlearning something. Imagine you sitting here and spending so much time on unlearning that you never actually get to do anything because your focus has been on why do I still think about this in this way? Why does my mind still remind me when I go to this area that I'm afraid? Why does my mind still remind me when I see some person that I have an initial judgment factor? So if you're going to spend all of your time focused on unlearning, it is going to come with this perfectionistic attitude that has to come that has to come as a result. And so for me, allowing ourselves to be unperfect in this fight, allowing ourselves to do this in such a way, it has to be intentional, of course. And so one, we do need to be addressing our harms as we are moving forward in our fight, but also at the same time, not getting to the point where we are in a paralysis because we're trying to find the absolute perfect solution. It won't exist. It's going to be sometimes individualized for an individual or sometimes just different for each community that you step into. And so flexibility has to be also part of the way that we move forward, knowing that there's not one answer to this, but there might be really so many different answers to this if we are willing to kind of like move forward with context as it's like brought in front of us or it's unfolding in front of us.
Yeah, I really appreciate the sort of appreciation of the idea that there is probably not one answer, right? That there's multiple and it's contextual and that it's nuanced. And I feel like a lot of people in general struggle with nuance. And I think we all, I don't know if it's a human instinct or what, but we all just want to see things black and white. We just want to see, like, I just do this thing and it takes care of everything. And that doesn't seem to be the reality for very many things, especially complex, complicated things like the topic that we're discussing here.
Absolutely.
One of the first problems that you outline in this paper is internalized racism and anti-blackness. Can you describe what that means, and sort of talk about how you began to sort of conceptualize this particular problem?
So as I consider racism, it would not benefit us to also consider the impacts of it for individuals, right? And so when we talk about racism, we must also know that internalized racism is inherently part of that same system. It's part of that same system. And so being able to speak about this in a way, I grew up in a predominantly Black area. But I remember learning some of the things that I see in the world from people who look like me. And as I again think about what the beloved community looks like, what we look like in the free world, it's going to require too that we address the ways in which we've been impacted by racism. And so anti-Blackness in itself, that said, you were talking about racism, but then we're specifically talking about racism against Black people, which is different. Like our experiences are not the same across the board from other people of color, right? And so they have their own specific experience, and we have our own specific experiences. And especially in the United States, we know to be Black is quite another level of racism. And so when we look at anti-Blackness as something that has been embedded in the fabric of America, I also want us to consider how we then think about ourselves in relation to other groups, in relation to the things that we've been taught about other groups. So really, being able to define those things out was important for this specific part of the paper. But again, I wanted to talk about the things that we go through as Black people when we are amongst ourselves or not amongst ourselves.
You provide several really helpful figures or diagrams to sort of explain or to demonstrate or to depict some of these conceptualizations behind these particular issues related to internalized racism and anti-Blackness. And then you go into depth on behavior analytic considerations. Can you talk about what some of those considerations are in terms of how to sort of try to take on this particular issue or to understand it?
So the part that you just mentioned about anti-Blackness and racism, I really pulled from RFT, so relational frame theory, to consider that. And again, it just goes back to my statement on unlearning, knowing that those frames exist and they can be pulled within any moment, right? In various contexts. But if we know these things, right, then how do we move forward as behavior analysts to combat anti-Black behaviors and also how to consider internalized racism within our space? And so, talking about the labels that we put on people, I say that, in order for us to get clear on this specific topic, we do need to look at this flexibly, but also honestly. I don't think that we really do it justice if we have people that go into a room and they act like they're holier than thou and they don't have these problems. They love all people, right? And so inside of this particular area in the paper, I put a scale in here, and it's really a it's a internalized racism scale. And it's just like a general scale that people can start to look at and say, like, is this true for me? Is this not true for me? The specific behaviors are, if I go into a workplace and I'm considered well-groomed or well-dressed, do I think that people are going to respect me? If I see large groups of Black people gathering together, what does that mean for me? Right. And so being able to kind of like look at these specific behaviors that are like that can come up on a day-to-day and see, like, are we impacted by those? Can we be honest about these things? Right. So that's the consideration is really about us looking at these things honestly, like with full honesty, not the, I know that I should say this. I know that if I don't say this the right way, I'm going to be judged. I think that's the work. Like the work has to be imperfect people coming together for the betterment of this world.
And did you write this section with the intention of like helping behavior analysts themselves work through this and like identify their own issues on this issue? Like, is that the intention here?
Yeah, this is definitely like the self-management area of the paper for sure.
Nice. Yeah, and again, really helpful in sort of diagrams and conceptualizations and tools embedded within that section. The next section is collective and racial trauma. Can you talk about what that means?
Yeah, so collective trauma essentially is talking about the shared learning history that we all have. And this can be by experiencing something directly or indirectly. So we heard about it, whether it's you turned on your TV and you saw this story of, or someone was telling you as you were on your way to work. It's a shared experience, it's a shared learning history, and that it can impact people from the similar or the same backgrounds. And so thinking about racism as collective trauma. Because there are a lot of trauma therapists out there too. And obviously, like behavior analytics scope of practice, a lot of us can, I am a trauma therapist, but a lot of us who are not counselors can claim to be trauma informed, but it's quite a difference of actually being a trauma therapist. And so I needed to put this in so that when we are talking about trauma informed care, that we're also recognizing that people are having shared experiences at similar times. So this component really got us to start to think about like how systemic oppression, how even like imagery of another Black death can impact people, whether, as an individual or collective within our field or in our workspaces.
And so the idea here is sort of describing how as a group of people, let's say Black people in America, how they are potentially going to be impacted on a large scale for things like seeing the death of George Floyd on the TV, right? Where it's, oh well, so and so lives in a state, 3 or 4 states away from him. What does that have to do with anything that happened with George Floyd? And it's like, well, seeing those images of someone being murdered, and having the sort of the racial underpinnings surrounding that whole issue is being something that's likely going to impact people in a meaningful way.
Yeah, one of the biggest takeaways from this section too is that we might be impacted by collective trauma without even realizing it. And so especially during those times and these times, you're seeing Black folks continue to go into the workforce, like continue to just go about their day to day. And being on this like autopilot while also experiencing the trauma. Some people may not be sensitive to it. And so you're having like these reactions of trauma, whether it's like I'm super hyper vigilant right now. And you may not have the terminology to put with it. And so I think it was important to also say that just because people act like they're okay does not mean that they are okay when these times are during these times.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. The next section of your paper focuses on an integrative behavioral model for Black liberation ultimately through the lens or the approach of acceptance and commitment therapy or ACT. Within that, you sort of have a description of how some of the tenets of ACT relate to Black liberation. Can we unpack some of that together and talk about that?
Yeah, so when I first learned of ACT, when I was first trained in ACT, it was again something else that I like had aha moment to. And I was reacting to it obviously because I have a counseling background. So I was like, yes, I really love getting at the private events, right? But it's some familiarity inside of this model. I grew up in a Black church. And so when you start talking about metaphors, I'm immediately sold because, I remember being in grad school and my teacher at the time, he was my mentor and my lab professor, but he said something like, Black people are circuitous. And I was like, are we really? And then I started to think about it. Like, yeah, we speak metaphorically, that's something that's very common. And so I thought that in itself is something that could connect with the Black community, being able to utilize metaphors inside this model. And within my work, and my counseling work, I use metaphors all the time utilizing this model. And I do get to see, I get to experience that it functions well for the community. So in this part, I wanted to talk about ACT potentially having familiarity with Black folks and that being a reason why it can potentially be utilized as a model to address internalized racism.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It's an interesting sort of connection that I wouldn't have initially sort of thought of going, oh, these components of ACT may be connecting with different communities for different reasons. Within your description of ACT and how it relates to Black liberation, you go through and hit some big areas, including like values and acceptance. Can we talk about those two pieces and how they ultimately relate?
Yeah, so actually in this part I go through all of the components of ACT. So I go through the hexaflex essentially and all the six concepts. And so I go through values, acceptance. I also go through diffusion because I think that is important. And so essentially what I wanted to do, present moment awareness, I go through that. But what I wanted to do was to go through every single last component and say, like, this is how you could potentially utilize ACT, and this is what it can mean. One of the things I want to say is, one, I started the paper off saying that Black liberation can be considered a value. And so this is like the assumption that if Black liberation is a value, then how do we break that down for the individual? So I like give examples of potential activities that people can utilize with their clients. And then for acceptance, I want to just highlight one of the things that I said is, and it may be also necessary for people to accept that racism still exists, right? That it is still part of the, it is still part of this country, it's still part of this world. But in general, what that might look like is there was a lot of adaptation from current ACT metaphors and ACT activities. And so for that, there's like a Black suffering inventory, which really talks about the things that people go through in term in relation to their Blackness. A present moment awareness, how do we become more sensitive to when these things are occurring in the moment? How do we defuse from some of the rules that we've been taught, whether again, directly or indirectly? How do we see ourselves, right? And then the last thing is like, how do we actually act towards the fight or towards our value of Black liberation?
And as sort of laid out here, do you see this and I'll almost present it as a dichotomy, doesn't have to be, but as sort of the original intention, do you see this as sort of a model to be used with Black individuals, or do you see this as being for white or other groups that don't have the direct experience of Black individuals, or do you see it as just being everyone, sort of, this is a model that could be used and beneficial for everyone?
Great question. So I do believe that this model is for Black people, but it can be adapted and tailored to other communities. The first thing I'll say is internalized racism is not just a phenomenon that happens for Black individuals. Latinx folks experience racism, Asian folks experience racism. And so their adaptations to these specific activities might be different. And I do think that someone could adapt it towards their community. I don't have direct connection to those communities, so it could not be me. The same for white folks. I truly believe that it would be great to see someone in a behavior analytics space take up such a brave space to address white supremacy and whiteness in a way that is personal and relational. I can't do that because I am not white and I don't have the same lived experience as you all do. And so that someone's going to be able to tact it more accurately than I ever could. And so I think, again, there's a potential to adapt it. But this specifically is written for Black people. And for, if there's anyone out there that like wants to take it and say like, what does this mean? How does this show up? You know, then that's great. I would love to see that really, because I think it that there's a such an amount of vulnerability that went into this paper, because I have a direct connection with my lived experience in connection to my community. And so I think that other groups are also going to need that direct connection.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, and sort of your point about the vulnerability because of the lived connection. Like, this is meaningful to you because it represents something that directly connects to you as an individual person, and I think that that is important in research. And I, you know, not to say people can't, you know, contribute or do research in things that don't necessarily have a direct connection to them, but the recognition that there is more vulnerability, there's sort of more at stake when you're like, hey, this thing directly relates to my community, to the people I care about, to myself individually, all of those pieces.
Yeah, I can only imagine. I can only imagine the lived experience of white people, the lived experience of whiteness. I can only imagine it. And so, if I were to create activities that gets people to like kind of like come into contact with their whiteness, could it be effective? I'm sure. Would it be most effective? Probably not, because once again, I can only imagine. I can only imagine what it's like. But I do believe that there is a history of shared trauma that white people share in relation to their race, that people can do this work that, again, that looks similar to what I've already done, but is directly connected to that experience.
Yeah, and I think that ties back to your earlier point about the nuance, right? Of, as you said, you don't have the experience of sort of being white, and therefore you're probably not going to be able to capture all the nuance. And sure, you can read a book on the topic, but that's like, it's not going to quite capture what it means, regardless of the book or the number of books, to sort of what the essence of what sort of the white experience is.
Yeah, absolutely.
The last two sections of your paper talk about storytelling and self-narration, and then the trauma-informed intervention. Can we talk about how these last two pieces sort of relate to everything and their importance in all of this?
Yeah, so these last two pieces, this is what makes it integrative, right? Because it's not just an ACT-based model, it's an integrative approach. Thinking about the components that are meaningful to the culture, storytelling and narrative is has been important to the Black culture. And so again, in order to imagine a new world, we have to be able to put something in its place. And so to have the ability to narrate, to self-narrate, to form a new story, but that's different than the one that you've been told about yourself, I think is going to be necessary. And I think the narration component that I have here is also it ties in beautifully with like the diffusion part and selfish context part. But narrative therapy in general allows us to kind of like use those narratives and create our own that don't have to be in alignment with what we've been told. And so we've had a lot of our history erased in this country. A lot of people don't know their lineage past a certain generation, a certain amount of generations. And so it's going to be important that we put in some narrative for ourselves. And I think that when we do that, it also can lead to some increased self-compassion and reduced guilt and shame that might be surrounding the things that we don't know or the things that we've been taught about each other. And so, yeah, I think it, like, again, it can merge into the self as context and diffusion part, but it's going to be important that we start to consider the narratives that we've been told. And one of the narratives that I talk about in the book, especially when you talk about internalized racism, is like this notion that, you know, Black people can't do these specific things. And that's what racism and white supremacy will have us to believe. Like, we can't walk down the street. We can't go for a jog. We can't sell loose cigarettes. We can't play with a toy gun. We can't do all these things. And so how do we reframe our experience? Because a lot of times what happens is then the onus and the ownership is on Black people to not do these things when the ownership needs to be somewhere else. And so being able to create a new narrative allows us to continue to see our humanity as it should be.
I love that, and I appreciate you sharing it. I think really this entire paper taking this integrative approach and looking at all these nuanced variables and sort of conceptualizing the issues and potential approaches to it has been really, really fascinating. It was a really interesting read, and I really appreciate the time that you took to and the vulnerability that sort of came along with that to write the paper and then to come on the show today to talk about it. I wish we had another 4 hours, honestly, to talk about this. There's just so many things, and this is such a encapsulating paper. I literally think we could have spent the entire hour just talking about the ACT component, or honestly, any individual pieces of this paper. And so this is a little bit of a flyover. So I really encourage the readers, if they want to learn more about it, to check out the paper, to check out the other stuff you're doing. But it's been a great resource for people who are interested in this topic and want to learn more. They should obviously check out your paper, the special issue. Are there other resources or areas of research or anything like that that people interested in learning more on this topic should check out?
Yeah, before I get to the resources, one thing I do want to say is that even though this paper is written for Black folks and with Black folks in mind throughout the entire thing, this is for everyone to read, truly is. Again, understanding our experiences also requires you to look at how we've been impacted by the larger systemic issues. And so I think this paper is for everyone, even though the person or the people that I wrote it for are Black individuals. Resources, one, I'm gonna always say look for resources that are outside of our field. The Pedagogy of the Oppressed by Paulo Freire is a book that was critical in my understanding. I really love that. Let's Talk About Race is another book by I'm gonna I can't remember the name of the author right now.
We can, and we'll link to all the books in the show notes too, so.
Perfect. And then some behavior analytic ones. Like I said, back in the I think around the 70s or so, there was a lot of literature that came out. But I think that you all can, there's a paper, Can Behavior Analysis Help Us to Understand and Reduce Racism, that people can start looking at, Changing Racial Bias by Transfer of Functions and Equivalence Classes is another one. So there's a few different papers that I think people could, and I can send you a list of some resources if that's easier after we conclude our recording.
Yeah, that'd be great. And we'll link to those in the show notes. Denisha, it's been a privilege to be able to talk to you today about this paper. I've really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed reading the paper and the special issue. So thank you for all of your meaningful work.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening. Please remember to subscribe and like us on whatever podcast player you use, and to find us and follow us on social media to stay up to date on our latest episodes. I'd like to thank a few people for helping create this podcast. Thanks to Stephanie Peterson, the editor of the journal Behavior Analysis and Practice, and ABAI for sponsoring this podcast. Thank you to my assistant producers, Jesse Perrin and Beyonce Ferrucci, for their assistance in this episode. And thank you to Jim Carr and his band, New Latitude, for letting us sample their song, Cruising Altitude, throughout this podcast.